unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good morning again. No. Please turn it back down again. Thank you. So we're going to continue talking about the Ehe Kosu Hotsu Gaman. Last week we discussed the first paragraph, and this week we're going to discuss the second and the beginning of the third paragraphs. Before we start that, however, I wanted to call attention to the fact that we lost a woman of great substance yesterday. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away. And I'm reminded of how much her life was a life of vow, how she used the gifts and talents and awareness that she had to serve beings. So let us just honor her and all people who serve in this world in whatever capacity, known and unknown. So let me read this. I'll read the first paragraph and then the second, and then we'll get started. So the first paragraph says, I vow with all beings from this life on throughout countless lives to hear the true Dharma, that upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us, nor will we lack in faith, that upon meeting it, we shall renounce worldly affairs and maintain the Buddha Dharma, and that in doing so, the great earth and all living beings together attain the Buddha way. So there's a lot packed in there, and we tackled some of it and the complexity of it last week, and then discussed it again in the class discussion group we had on Wednesday night. This next paragraph, although our past evil karma has greatly accumulated, indeed being the cause and condition of obstacles in practicing the way, may all Buddhas and ancestors who have attained the Buddha way be compassionate to us and free us from karmic effects, allowing us to practice the way without hindrance. The official Sotoshu translation is, although we have accumulated much bad karma in the past, producing causes and conditions that obstruct the practice of the way, may the Buddhas and ancestors who have attained the way of the Buddha take pity on us and liberate us from karmic entanglements and remove obstructions to our study of the way. So, again, there's a lot here. And what we begin with is this complex topic of karma. This is one of those words, like many central words we encounter when we take up the study of Buddhism. It has a long, long history, including a pre-Buddhist history, and it has been understood in many ways, many different ways. And in our encounter with Buddhism in contemporary life, it has also been misunderstood in many ways. So I want to take some time to talk about this topic and provide us with some basis for engaging with it. If we add to the fact that sotas and teachings often turn us around, saying one thing, then another, it's no wonder that there's some confusion about it. So it's good to review the basics and then move on into Dogen's teachings about this. Basically, karma means cause and effect. It is a specific aspect of the broader teachings of dependent origination, pratichasamuppada. What this means fundamentally is that all things arise in concert with everything else, and they're dependent for their arising upon everything else. Fundamentally, there is nothing you can separate from reality. Nothing that is apart. The arising of this is the arising of every other aspect of reality in this moment. And because of this interdependence, one thing has myriad, in fact, infinite causes. So we can think of an orange, for example. An orange does not grow out of a plum blossom. And a poppy does not grow out of a bean. But if it were not for the soil, the air, the sun, the birds, and all the things that support their lives, the orange and the poppy would not exist. And that particular orange, that particular poppy, would not exist. Forms of life are not generic. Each orange, each poppy, each person is both an example of the generality of life coming forward and the very specific nature of that entity arising from myriad causes and conditions. This is complex, and cause follows effect and is the cause for further effects. It is important to know this. It's also really important to understand that according to the Buddha Dharma, there is not a God or an other being who starts everything, intervenes in life, or judges actions. This is neutral in a sense. In Buddha's teachings, there's one more piece that's central, and that is intention. What makes karmic actions unique in this wider causal system is that they arise from intention, volition, cetana. This has important implications for our understanding and how we live our lives. One way this has been characterized is the planting and fruition of seeds. Like I said, an orange doesn't come from a plum blossom. There's a sequence. One model of talking about this is the Buddhist 12-fold chain of causation. I've talked about this before, and it shows us how we perpetuate delusion in our own minds and in our actions. I don't want to go into it today, but I would recommend it. Spend some time with it. Think about how it describes your life and the way in which delusion is perpetuated. There's agency here. This is not a mechanistic model. It is not a kind of fate. There's always a pivot point, always a pivot point in the Buddhist teachings, and the ability to plant wholesomeness, the ability to move, to bring intention. I was thinking the other day about times in my own life when someone has said or done something, especially when I was young and confused, not that I'm not confused now, but when I was young and confused, and someone would say something and it just would pivot the way I saw things. And out from that flowed different actions. We do this for each other. It happens all the time. So we have to be aware of this. We can see the karma, we can see this activity both individually and systemically. For example, in the last few months, our society has begun to uncover and face the fact of systemic racism and its impact. If we look around us and at our own minds, we can see it. Seeing in this way is a very good thing. We can spot delusion. This is what Buddha said under the Bo tree. When Mara, delusion was coming at him, he says, "Mara, I see you as Mara." When we see delusion, we are not trapped by it. We become agents of change. Well, we might also ask, where did this systemic delusion start? And for that, we turn to our culture and say, we swim in it. We are shaped and molded by all the history, the culture, the multiple factors that color our lives. But we also have to recognize that this grows from individual actions. I am not a historian, but I know enough to know that the slave trade in Britain was a major source of the tragedy that has unfolded since. Individual people have to have made choices about how they were going to make their money and how much they needed. Individual people have to have said, I will use my ships to transport kidnapped human beings under horrific conditions to another part of the world and sell them to other human beings. And I will make money doing it. Greed and delusion, that is delusion in not seeing the horror of it or ignoring it, led to hatred and great suffering. Individual people had choice. And that choice is both reflective of the system in which they were and also supported it. So we are shaped by the system we live in, but we always have the option to wake up. In our case, we have the option to take seriously the teachings of the Buddha. We also have the opportunity to follow the examples of those who act in wholesome and liberative ways, no matter what teachings they follow, if any. Because a commitment to liberation is also systemic. We may feel that our actions are minor and don't add up to the changes we want to see. We may become discouraged. But I think that is simply ignoring our responsibility to the world. And it also means that we assume we know what our impact will be, but we can't. We can only live according to our most deep intention. When we act, and that means internal actions, what we do with our thoughts, our emotions, our responses, as well as our external reactions, how we behave with others, how we express our lives, how we hold our bodies, our tone of voice, everything. All of this is a part of this cause and effect, and all of it is impacted by intention. What we look at and see is we want to understand, are these actions, internal and external, wholesome? Do they lead to wholesome outcomes? This is known as kusala. Or do they lead to unwholesome actions? This is known as akusala. Or are they neutral? We orient ourselves toward kusala, wholesomeness. And this brings wholesomeness alive in the system. Again, the key factor here is intention. And that too is complex. For example, if a small animal runs in front of our car as we are driving and we accidentally kill it, that is very different in terms of the karmic impact on us and others from intentionally acting to kill it. We can see this when we look in our own minds and hearts. We might be hungry and we are grumpy with someone. That's different than, and we can apologize. We can say, oh, I'm hungry. I'm feeling grumpy right now. That's different than saying, I want to punch. I want to hit back. It has a different impact on us and it has a different impact on others. But to come back to this driving example, we can also step back and look broadly. When we're driving a huge hunk of metal down a road at a speed that is beyond the capacity of this animal to avoid. Why are we doing that? Habit, convenience. because this is how our world works now. Because in order to afford a place to live, we need to live far away from our job so that we can make enough money to support our family. All of this. We don't want to overwhelm ourselves by looking in this way, but we need to recognize that we are swimming within a karmic system and that we have choice at the same time. There's no blame here. Just awareness, curiosity, and openness. And a desire for our intentions and actions to be wholesome and life-giving to ourselves and all beings. It's important to not get rigid or precious about this, or to sink into overwhelm. It's just simple. We just do this thing and this thing and this thing. Buddhist teachers and philosophers have come up with many, many, many and very elaborate systems about how to explain the relationship and the fact that the Buddha also teaches that the self has no inherent existence. Well, if the self has no inherent, no separate existence from everything else, isn't it just kind of this passive mechanistic thing? We've said, no, it's not. And the other question is, how is karma carried forward? People thought a lot about from lifetime to lifetime, but even if we set that aside, what about moment to moment? How to reconcile this teaching is not easy. It is a kind of intellectual rabbit hole that we could go down and study innumerable philosophical systems that could consume lifetimes in and of itself. So I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to place that question in front of you and say, what do you think about this? And what do you think about contradiction? How do we live with contradiction? When we enter into Dogen's teachings, not just in this one text, but in his many teachings, contradictions abound. We have to be willing to enter them, to understand that each of these ways of approaching the Dharma has something to teach us, that it has power, that it is transformative. We have to learn to live in that place. We have to be willing to allow that challenge to come close to us, to be intimate with us, to live it out as creatively and as lively a way as the teachings that come to us. These are creative teachings. They're meant to liberate us. So our response needs to be creative and liberative. We so want to know. We want to fit things into our pre-existing categories. And you know, it's a good start. That's a good start. But we can't stop there. We have to know that that's a starting point, and we have to be willing to live into this complexity, this contradiction. So we start by acknowledging that our view is limited, bound and conditioned by karma, by the causes and conditions of our life. Because of that, we cannot see clearly most of the time, at least not in the long run. Often we are pulled by our karma, our likes and dislikes, greed, aversion, delusion, avoidance, what we are conditioned to see, to like, to want, pulled by it. In Japanese, this is a life of bundan shoji, separating birth and death. The bodhisattva, on the other hand, the person who has oriented themselves toward liberation, towards awakening for the benefit of themselves and all beings, through their practice and their vow, their lives are henyaku shoji, transforming life and death, not pulled by likes and dislikes, aware and not pushed around by what one sees, feels, thinks. With this life, life is transformed, and one can be stable, creative, beneficial in the world. This is the freedom of the bodhisattva. Not having eliminated karma, but freed from being dominated by it. In fact, the circumstances of any one moment, both internal and external, become the opportunity to enter practice more deeply. This can be very hard sometimes, but it's true. Each moment, are we turned or are we being turned? Both, usually. The self that is alive to this is alive and responsive with all beings. The dynamic reality of this moment. And it's quite ordinary. No need for something else, something special, apart from our day-to-day lives. In this way, one's center of gravity is not the self that is pulled by karma. We don't need to deny that. But the center of gravity is not in that. The center of gravity is with all beings, the entire reality of this moment, the vow of the bodhisattva. So we don't ignore or deny our individual habits of mind, heart, and body. We work with them. We do not ignore individual and systemic delusion, how we are shaped by our personal experience, our history, our gifts, our talents, our limitations, how delusion is present and perpetuated in our societies. We do not ignore either of them. With this, we establish the stability and the clarity and the kindness to see our own minds and to see our world. And we call on all our wisdom to respond. This is freedom. This is transformed and transforming life and death. So, we do not do this with a fixed view of a particular outcome. Of course we hope. We're guided by aspiration for all beings to be eased, to find peace, to know freedom from suffering. But aware of all the causes and conditions and aware that we live in this saha world, we find a kind of joyfulness, perhaps, connection and alignment in our lives with our deepest intention. Making a contribution with energy towards a wholesome world. This is life in this reality. And it gives us heart, I think, clarity. This is not abstract. It takes place every moment. You may have also noticed in this second paragraph that we're talking about today, the word evil. This is a real catcher for people. Again, we need to put this word in context. Evil is not meant to indicate a fixed state, much less the action of a malevolent being. Evil is akusala, profoundly unwholesome, deluded, dominated by delusion. We recognize that our past actions, individually and collectively, have created suffering for ourselves and others, obstacles to practice. Obstacles include a lack of clarity about what is most important to us, a false view of separation between ourselves and others, distractions. Our past actions have also brought us positive forces, clarity, caring, engagement. We look at our own lives and see our choices and see what we have fed and not. And we look at our community's lives and choices. We cannot know all the circumstances that have contributed to a certain outcome. This is one of the teachings. Myriad causes and conditions. All the ways we have contributed to the fires that have destroyed so much for example. But we can see what we can see, and we can respond. We can wake up, and we can live this transforming life death of Henyaku Shoji. We do this in connection with all beings. And as Dogen points out, we call on all the Buddhas and ancestors to help us. We can understand the Buddhas and ancestors as actual positive forces in the world. Many, many cultures do this. This seems to make many contemporary people, at least in this country, quite uncomfortable. So if it's helpful, we can think of Buddhas as awakened possibility in the world. What is available to us if we pay attention. And that awakening can arise at any moment. It is always available. When we are caught in our small little world, when we feel helpless or alone, we can call on that capacity to wake up. It is never absent. In so doing, we expand our perspective, and our center of gravity shifts, expands, eases. We welcome another way of responding, one based in the teachings of the Buddha, a compassionate and wise perspective. This changes us. It brings us into intimacy with our world, and that is transformative. So then we consider ancestors. Ancestors are those that have gone before. And so I ask you, how could we be separate from them? We are our ancestors in a very real physical way. And you know what? We will be ancestors. There are a number of people, Joanna Macy and others, who are writing and speaking about how seeing ourselves as a part of a stream of ancestors, as future ancestors, and what happens when we do, what happens when we think that way. When we remember we have responsibility to our ancestors and to the future generations to which we will be ancestors. This is another dimension of interdependence. It both honors the reality of linear time and it collapses it. Our ancestors are here right now. And the impact on the future is here right now. Right in our actions. What we do matters. So calling on the ancestors not only brings to mind the courage, tenacity, creativity, and beauty that our ancestors had, as well as their mistakes, their greed, and poisonous actions, it places us in a wider, more accurate context. It broadens our view and diminishes the tiny, self-obsessed life that we can sometimes be caught in. It's important to remember that this takes place in our ordinary lives in each moment. We are ancestors and we are our ancestors, we are ancestors to the future, and we receive from the ancestors in each moment. So in day to day, we ask that the Buddhas and ancestors show us compassion. That compassion come alive for us, all that we've received and continue to receive. That they support us, just as we hope to live lives that show compassion and support to the generations that follow. This is a dynamic reality. It includes everything. We ask that they share with us boundless compassion. This compassion exists if only we can see it. There are many images and stories that point to the boundless wisdom and compassion that exists. One that's quite well known in the Zen world, is we can think of it this way, is the hazy moon of enlightenment. That the moon is always present, whether we can see it or not. And that as humans, we live in the world in which the moon is often, quite often, not visible to us. In the midst of haze. But we should not be discouraged by this. Quite the opposite. Because you see, the haze is also a dimension of enlightenment. Our lives are not aimed at some mythical purity. Our lives, as they are, haze, moon, stumbling, waking up, are the fullness of reality. This is Dogen's teachings. We are not escaping into purity. We are alive in this particular world. We ask that the Buddhas and ancestors to be compassionate to us. This is both a request and a model for our own actions, our interdependence with Buddhas and ancestors. We say Buddhas and ancestors of old were as we in the future will be Buddhas and ancestors. We are not different. They were human too, subject to pettiness, delusion, anger, suffering, and angst. And we have the same capacity to wake up as they did. In fact, we are not different from them. This moment is the whole arising of all of it. Enlightenment is not something to be gained in the future. It is the basis of our lives and practice. Dogen teaches us that we live at the intersection of the particular and vastness. We are both. We do not seek to escape the particular. That is not only not possible, it leads to a life lived with fraughtness, as I said last week, chasing our tail. And we do not become convinced and caught in our particularity. Well, we do, often. And then we wake up. How do we wake up? We reach out. We know we're connected. We know kindness. We know the teachings. We are never separate from the boundless interdependence of this reality, both at the same time. When we allow and support the center of gravity to shift, even for a moment, when our perspective expands, we are both limited and not limited by our karmic conditions. And we can respond with all beings to undo the harmful effects of our delusion. This is important. To think of ourselves as separate, it makes it impossible for us to be free. It only perpetuates the view that keeps us bound. Our freedom comes when we are not fooled by our foolishness and delusion. This makes possible a clear and deeply compassionate life based on the whole of reality, including our delusions. So our practice is to support the conditions that allow this shift in our center of gravity to take place, from tiny, karmically bound self to one who knows itself to be the expression of all being. We do this by staying awake, practicing compassion, keeping an eye on our individual and systemic karma, calling out to the Buddhas and ancestors, and engaging with the world based on our identity with it. This takes shape in our particular vow, which I've been encouraging you to write, and our particular way of Buddha, of living, the Buddha way. So let me read to you this last paragraph again, and then we'll close. Although our past evil karma has greatly accumulated, indeed being the cause and condition of obstacles in practicing the way, May all Buddhas and ancestors who have attained the Buddha way be compassionate to us and free us from karmic effects, allowing us to practice the way without hindrance.